I'm Andrea.
Blake.
We feel like Regis and Kathy Lee right now. And we're presenting the Anarchists and the Academy Theorists of Revolt or Revolting Theory presentation, which is Blake's title. And we thought we'd give you a bit of a sense of where we're coming from, because we're both obviously pretty young. And so I'll go first. I'm turning 25, and I just dropped out of a master's program at Harvard Divinity School, which is, you know, my claim to fame among my friends, but, you know, some people think it's good. My parents aren't too happy. And so I'm now back in Montreal and sort of happily getting involved in more organizing things there and contemplating doing different types of school. And this paper has sort of been a good opportunity to reflect on that decision sort of retroactively, and I'm hoping that this conversation will be a good way of either challenging the decision or solidifying it or just having a sense of what other people think, because I sort of felt isolated in making it and whatever. So
I'm Blake. I go to school in McGill University in Montreal, which is also, well, it likes to call itself the Harvard of the North, but it isn't really that good, but
without the budget.
Yeah, but it's definitely like an upper class, very like scholarly kind of school, and so that's the sort of stuff I have to deal with. And I have, I don't know, I sometimes wonder why I'm still there, and this is sort of a reflection on that also.
That said, we wrote this 13-page thing, and it was a conscious attempt to not be reactionary, despite, you know, our qualms about the academy and the reliance of theory on an academic setting. And it was really an attempt to sort of do what I call taking theory seriously. And we tried to sort of perform that while we wrote. So there's some sort of dense theoretical passages, and I think they'll sort of be somewhat obliterated today for lack of time and the fact that dense theory doesn't really travel well necessarily, but hopefully we'll have like a copy of this. If any of you would like it, you can email us maybe after so we can figure that out. So basically the outline for this presentation is going to be that Blake's going to sort of start by using Malatesta to sketch sort of what the classical European canon anarchist writers seem to present as the anarchist intellectual and that person's task. And then I'm going to make a couple of sort of theoretical interventions using Foucault and Gayatri Spivak to sort of dialogue with that and maybe revise it a bit. And then we're going to move into talking about the academy as it exists in a North American context now and raise a whole range of questions about that. Last but not least, and sort of maybe most importantly, a question of the division of labor between intellectual and non-intellectual labor. And then we're going to talk. So.
Okay. So actually, yeah, I'm going to use sort of Malatesta as a starting point for a lot of the classical anarchist theory, but I'd like to start off with talking about Lenin, actually, just for sort of a counterpoint. I know it's kind of a strange thing to do in an anarchist conference, but I'd like to just sort of start out that way. So for Lenin, this is a beautiful quote, "The history of all countries shows that the working class exclusively, by its own effort, is able to develop only trade union consciousness." So the workers by themselves, for Lenin, are going to be very reformist. They're not going to ever want revolution on their own. And for Lenin, revolution is the only solution to society's problems. So if the workers aren't going to be revolutionary on their own, revolution is the only solution to society's problems. You need some other element there. For Lenin, this is the socialist intelligentsia. This is like the vanguard party. This is the professional revolutionaries. And this is because for Lenin, socialism is something that comes from, like, their academic or not even academic, but intellectual thought has created bourgeois and socialist ideology. That's it. So, and socialism has to be brought to the masses. It's not in any way inherent in them. So that's something that theorists have to do, bring socialism to the masses. And they have to educate the workers about the need for revolution. And then, of course, I'm sure we're all familiar with Lenin's sort of theory on how revolution is supposed to go, that you're supposed to seize the apparatus of the state, use it to crush the resistance of the bourgeoisie, and then eventually it's supposed to wither away. Lots of critiques of that, but that's the theory behind it. To anarchists, we find this probably pretty scary because it's, first of all, it doesn't happen, but also it's the sort of willingness to put off organizing in a democratic or decentralized way. And also the like, as anarchists, we usually believe that people have to liberate themselves, and that the direction from like a party or a vanguard of that kind is really much more damaging than it is helpful. Malatesta, for example, says, "To fight our enemies effectively, we do not need to deny the principle of freedom, not even for one moment." So we want to organize in a democratic way. Does this mean, for Malatesta, does this mean that we can just... Malatesta is an anarchist communist. Does this mean that we can institute anarchist communism today? No, it doesn't, because there's the state, there's this huge apparatus that exists to defend authority and privilege and the status quo. So for Malatesta, revolution, which is for Malatesta just a triumphant insurrection, the point of revolution is to destroy the barriers to anarchist communism, specifically the police, especially. But revolution sort of knocks out of the way the things that make it impossible for people to develop into really truly democratic or anarchist communist ways of living at the time. So for Malatesta, he sort of reverses the Leninist approach in a certain sense. He would say that what Lenin tries to do is impose communism on people and then let anarchism develop, which doesn't happen. Whereas Malatesta would say that he sort of reverses this. He wants to start off on a much more anarchist foot by attacking the state and well, hopefully destroying the state, and then letting communism develop more slowly, but getting rid of the barriers more. And this obviously has certain advantages because, as libertarian socialists, it's hard to imagine how people could function in a communist way without choosing it themselves. So, whereas Malatesta would argue that Lenin tries to enforce this, he would say that communism has to be chosen by the people, and that's why it's libertarian. So really, the revolution is just about creating the conditions so communism can develop. So it's much more like anarchist first, communism slowly developing, kind of a reversal of Lenin. So for what is the idea about where socialism comes from then in Malatesta? For Malatesta, socialism is in some sense there in the masses. It's not that like anarchist communism is like the genes of the masses, but it's about the role of the intellectual is to sort of interpret the instincts of the people, or to, he uses that phrase, interpret the instincts, or to sort of give an articulation, or to help the people to educate themselves, to awaken a spirit of revolt in the people, to technically prepare the insurrection. Because at the time, Malatesta would say that at the time of an insurrection, not everybody is going to be an anarchist communist. So what the forward-looking revolutionaries have to do is prepare the insurrection so that it can be successful, so that it can destroy these barriers to anarchist communism, and then they can develop. So the basic idea of the intellectual that starts to come out of this is someone who advises, someone who teaches, sets examples, technically helps out, but you know, above all, never gives commands, never gives orders. Yes. So the idea then is that if people are willing to take on this role of the intellectual, if people are willing to not command and to sort of interpret the instincts of the masses, then they're totally welcome, and in fact they're necessary. They're necessary for all these tasks because, as Malatesta says, quote, "We are revolutionaries and know that a revolution made without the participation of forces and values which cannot be acquired without an intellectual background could appear to be radical, but in fact would be no more than an explosion of anger without significance and without a future. So for Malatesta, the intellectuals, in some sense, or at least the intellectual background, is very necessary to have a successful revolution that's actually going to change things in a sort of permanent way. Now, it's also somewhat more complicated because, as Malatesta would say, the only way to seriously change something, like, it's not just about abolishing barriers, because the only way to seriously destroy a barrier is by replacing it, and replacing things, especially economic institutions that are supposedly more liberatory for Malatesta would be more communist institutions. So it's not quite as cut and dry as anarchism first, communism second, but it's more starting off on an anarchist foot. So intellectuals then are you know, welcomed with open arms into the proletariat. And for Malatesta, there's this really strong emphasis on the irreconcilable class conflict. Like, there's lower class, I mean, it's not quite proletariat bourgeoisie, but it's pretty close to that. Like, there's poor people and there's rich people. And if you come to the proletarian side, that implicitly means you have a really harsh critique of the bourgeoisie. But then you are welcomed in and you're necessary. So it's just interesting to draw the connections then between what Lenin would view, where you need to bring socialism to the masses, and Lenin, so then you can sort of see how Lenin's way of going about revolution is reflected in that, because, first of all, he doesn't have a big problem with temporary authoritarian discipline, or what he would call temporary authoritarian discipline. And he writes pages condemning the spontaneity of the masses and whole pamphlets, because this is just degrading the program of socialism. Whereas for Malatesta, he'll say things like, everything depends on what the people are capable of wanting, and it's much more about interpreting the instincts of the masses and help trying to get people to liberate themselves.
So, I guess one of the ways in which I see either a need, or I think it would be more accurate to say, I think we can describe a lot of contemporary anarchists in their collectives, in their organizing, as having sort of updated this, like, sort of Malatesta's vision of the anarchist intellectual that Blake described, is that, in first of all, I think we have a more complicated notion of power, so hence the Foucault. Because I don't think in our, at least in the organizing collectives I've been a part of, although class is certainly an issue and that opposition is still there, and, power can't simply be conceived as sort of binary bourgeoisie or state bourgeoisie against a proletariat class. That's not really convincing, not only because transnational corporations have sort of made it strategically necessary to recognize them as institutions with a range of political and economic power, and a capacity for exploitation that rivals most states, but also because the need to be critical of coercive relationships in our own collectives and in our own organizations, as well as sort of in a broader society, has required that we reconceptualize the location and the operation of power. The growing concern with addressing racism, sexism, heterosexism in purportedly anarchist collectives and organization has made us ask, or I think at best makes people ask, sort of strategic questions like, where in this specific situation is power? So we ask things like, if power doesn't just appear in sort of an inverse proportion in the state and in the revolutionary masses, or as the repressive force of the state, or as the liberatory zeal of the people, how does it appear and how does it act? And power gets reconceptualized as in terms of an intersection of a range of forces that we frequently describe in terms of the race, class, gender, and geopolitical location of individual or group actors in a given situation, while we recognize that those terms can also be seen as the production of specific sets of political and social forces and groupings of power relationships. So In this sense, like, attention is paid to the ways in which networks of relations privilege certain patterns of speaking and acting while they make other discourses, if you want to use that word, unintelligible or meaningless in given situations. And I think at best we also pay attention to the sense in which those patterns of speaking and acting also support or resist the set of relationships in which, by which they're privileged and made comprehensible. I'm trying to go through this very quickly. So these are the questions contemporary anarchists, whether we want to call ourselves theorists or if we just want to call ourselves organizers, I think do ask. And while I've used Foucault's sort of description of power to make this point, I think it raises the question that because whether or not I've used Foucault, the fact is that people are increasingly reconceiving power this way, whether or not they give a damn about sort of Foucault's section on method in part 3 of the Introduction to the History of Sexuality. The second way in which I'd want to revise sort of Malatesta has to do with the notion of fusion. And so Malatesta argues for a fusion. We accept the intellectuals with pleasure and without suspicion when they fuse with the working class, when they join the people without pretensions to command. And then he goes on to sort of elaborate about the sort of disposition of the fused intellectual. And I think that sort of a correlate of seeing power in a more complicated way is a need to question sort of the implication or the presumptions that this desire for fusion assumes. It seems to me to assume that the experience of members of a proletarian class emerges from a realm that's somehow pure and true and somehow beyond ideological distortion. And it also assumes that it's possible. That it's very possible for somebody from a class of intellectuals to fuse and to have the desires of a different class become immediate and to sort of become effaced, to have their own individual operation effaced as they sort of transparently interpret or spew back the articulation, an unarticulation of the desires of that class. I don't think that's particularly convincing at this point, and I'm going to choose not to go through Spivak right now because we're already, like, over time, I think. But I think Gayatri Spivak in Can the Subaltern Speak comes down harshly on leftist intellectuals in general for making the assumption that they can sort of transparently report on what oppressed classes, which for a lot of us, I think, somehow, like, operates the same way that proletarian class does for Malatesta. She challenges that, and so I urge you to look at that essay. And I think we should move to the Academy. Oh, yeah, I'm the first to talk about the Academy. Well, today, I think I think the Academy has become the locus of intellectual life. And it's certainly, I mean, the research university is sort of the place where most theorists reside. And it's offered, I think, we read a lot of Russell Jacoby for this. And I mean, he gives a pretty convincing, I guess, account of the migration of intellectual life from Bohemian Greenwich Village in the 50s to sort of university campuses in the 60s. And he also writes convincingly about the sense in which sort of the security of having tenure and having sort of the comfort, like the basic comforts of life assured for intellectuals was supposed to give them the freedom to be vastly critical of structures of power. And I've sort of like, I guess already said that I think that's a priority for contemporary anarchist intellectuals by using Foucault. So that was the idea. He also sort of shows how in fact, the university just sort of ended up, because of a whole range of issues, gave academics the freedom to be academic, and has functioned to actually quell a fair amount of dissent. And so the most obvious manifestation of that is sort of an academic freedom issue. And I think that's the least interesting. So, but I have an interesting story about it, because when I was considering dropping out this year, I went to my advisor, who's like this wonderful liberal, well-meaning man who, like, I love, really. And I, you know, he was like, well, Andrea, he listened to all my concerns about, you know, being at Harvard and blah, blah, blah. He's like, you know, Andrea, first of all, academia is just, it's a second order engagement. I don't really know what that means, but I think it meant you don't go to demos, like, or you don't really hope to change things, you know? And the second thing he said, just trying to be really honest, you know, was like, well, if you can live with the fact that you're basically going to have to toe the line and not rock the boat very much or at all for 6 years while you finish a PhD, and then for 6 or 8 more years while you get tenure, then you should stay. But if you can't live with that, then you should leave, because that's how it is. So I was like, okay. Said you. But I just, on the one hand, I was like thankful because he was so honest. But on the other hand, I think it's a horrible statement about what's expected of intellectuals, you know, if they now reside in the academy. And I think it says something very frightening about our capacity as anarchists to pursue really critical work there. So that's all I'm going to say about that. And except that also, I think if you're less so in the humanities, but if you're in areas in which funding is largely procured from corporate sources, the situation's even worse.
Another thing that Jacobi, and we're just saying Jacobi because I was introduced to this guy by an Italian person who pronounced it Jacobi. It could be Jacobi. I have no idea.
We have no idea.
Another thing that he critiques in the academy that I think you can see is a sort of specialized, like there's this strong emphasis on publishing and publishing in specialized fields. So there's like a specific rule in a lot of departments, whether sometimes it's written and sometimes it's just sort of an unwritten rule, that you have to have 2 books published by the time you get tenure, if you want to get tenure. And also the idea is that you want your stuff to be the top of the field, and you're in the top of the field by publishing a lot of stuff in your field. What this Jacobi's critique then is that this doesn't really encourage more better scholarship. What this does is just sort of encourage creation of micro fields and specialized fields, and along with these specialized fields goes a specialized language. One of the things that sort of aggravates this or is a bad example of this is the tendency to use citation indices as for promotion and just to generally see how influential somebody is. So a citation index will show like who's being quoted a lot. So if you're being quoted a lot, you're supposedly influential. One of the problems with this then is it will tend to develop a scholarship that quotes a lot of people and small specialized fields of people who sort of trade citations and cite a whole bunch of people in their works, trying to get them to cite them back. Mm-hmm. And like you can imagine what sort of work comes out of this and how it becomes less and less accessible to a general audience, whatever that means. So I think this is another sort of valid critique that Jacobi brings to the discussion. My main critique of Jacobi, though, is that his whole critique is sort of contrasted to what he sees as the public intellectual. And the public intellectual is someone who speaks to the educated public. But he doesn't really talk about division of labor in any sense. It's more like just specialized. He doesn't seem to have any sort of fundamental problem with the fact that there are intellectuals and non-intellectuals. And that's one of the things that I think we can actually take from classical anarchists to critique like, contemporary intellectuals in a good way. I think classical anarchists have been very strong. Classical anarchists have always been very very sort of skeptical of intellectuals as intellectuals, because the division between manual and like manual work and brain work is a false one. It's created by capitalism. Malatesta says that when intellectuals want to fuse with the masses, they have to do it with the open mind of someone who comes in the midst of brothers to repay to them a debt he has contracted in educating himself and cultivating his intellect, which in most cases is at the expense of the children of those whose manual labor or whose manual work has produced the means. So the idea is that intellectuals are sort of exempt from the community work. So in Kropotkin's socialist, anarchist, communist utopia, he talks about sort of the ideal in which everyone works 4 to 5 hours from age 20 to 45 or 50, just providing the basic needs for society. And then after that, you can do intellectual work. So another sort of view of intellectual work in general comes out of Kropotkin's work, where he says that besides, like, Kropotkin's not so interested in, or he doesn't write as much about theory in a revolutionary struggle. He writes more about theory and, not even theory, but intellectual work, almost as an art, like something that you can engage in after you've done your digging potatoes or whatever it is that you do for the community. That's and so I think the classical anarchists in general then are useful in sort of critiquing the idea that you can have intellectuals by themselves who don't have to do their share of the shit work in the community. So what Malatesta says is, all would work, including the poets and the transcendental philosophers, without any ill effects to poetry or philosophy.
In case you were worried. I think another interesting thing, there's a link between what Blake talked about in terms of a specialized, the proliferation of specialized discourses in the academy and the division of labor and the way in which academics seem to function almost as a class on their own, or, you know, if you don't want to see them adhering strictly to, like, sort of an upper class. Because the complexity and the impenetrability of a lot of those specialized discourses sort of functions to legitimate the need for, you know, quiet, gated campuses in which no, you know, physical work sort of interrupts your time to reflect and really penetrate those difficult words, you know, and to decipher all the jargon, and freedom from any other sort of work, and increasingly at the best universities or the best universities, it seems also to mean sort of that the people at the top of their fields don't even have to teach anymore, because that sort of distracts them from really producing, you know, new words to add to the lexicon. So I think, yeah, I just think specialization and division of labor are really intimately linked, and I think that's an interesting thought to pursue at some point. All of this sort of brings us back to the overarching questions we had when we wrote our proposal in May, and that are printed in the program, and they're basically, can anarchist theory be done in the academy? And if not, because of some of the critiques we've launched, or for other reasons that you hopefully will bring up, what counts as scholarly work or theoretical work is so reliant on the academy right now, and is heavily reliant also on a distinction between intellectual and non-intellectual labor and sets of people who do one or the other. What does it mean to do scholarly work as an anarchist? What does it mean to take theory seriously if we also take Malatesta's view that it is necessary for revolutionary change? So those are questions, really broad questions, I'd like to open up. And maybe a more specific focus question is, and maybe a more, I don't know, traditionally constructive one is, how would we want to conceive of an anarchist theoretical practice? And in other words, what are we doing here? So I think we're going to take a speakers list if it proves necessary, but I'll just wait for any of you if you'd like to comment.